Let me take this opportunity to welcome all of you,
in particular the Minister, Deputy Minister, the Director General. I saw you promoting the green economy with your green tie this morning. The Commissioner for SARS, the staff for National Treasury, from National Treasury. Let me indicate that this is a joint sitting of the finance committees from both the NCOP and then the National Assembly. But in our midst here, we also have chairpersons of committees of finance from the provinces. I might not have identified all of them at this moment, but I see Gauteng is here, Limpopo, Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, Free State. Free State is here. What other province? Well, I'm told others may be still on their way. They'll join us. Minister, we decided to have this arrangement because we are trying to make sure that whatever the briefing you give at the National Assembly and NCOP level, we also share the same information with our provinces so that the processes of processing and the budget deliberations, both in terms of public hearings and the internal committee debates, are synchronized. For the reasons that we've discussed with your office and the office of the Speaker and the chairperson of the NCOP, so that we can be able to manage time more efficiently. So I thought I should give this background. With me here will be my co-chair, Charles De Beer, Select Committee on Finance from the NCOP. The afternoon session, because we're going to have two sessions, of which you are not necessarily required to attend both, Minister. And we understand because of your heavy schedule. The afternoon session is going to be around more around the Division of Revenue, which is more detailed and technical, and we believe that your good team will be able to handle that. And that session will be chaired by, or co-chaired by, Honorable Sogoni and Honorable Chani. That will be in the afternoon. So I thought I should just explain the processes and also welcome you, but also congratulate on behalf of the joint committees for your eloquent presentation, both in terms of depth and detail of the budget, not depth of talent, depth and detail of the budget. I must also say you have managed to give more flesh to the State of the Nation address yesterday. But the rest remains for committee members to act with in terms of your presentation this afternoon or this morning. Let me take this opportunity to welcome you and hand over to your good self and your team to direct us on how you're going to handle today's deliberations. I must also say I did not recognize Bongani, the chair of the FFC, a very important component of our work particularly in terms of the division of revenue, both horizontal and vertical, but more specifically on the horizontal side. I think that's where they play a very important role in making sure that there's equitable distribution of resources between and among the spheres of government. Thank you, Honorable Minister. You're welcome.
Thank you very much for your kind remarks and greetings to all of the chairpersons. I'm not sure how many there are here, and to honorable members. And thank you very much for this opportunity for myself and our team to take you through the budget once again. The last thing we need is too much of details that puts you off to sleep, because you heard some of it yesterday and had many hours to study some of the documents as well. Nonetheless, it'll be good to refresh some elements of what we said yesterday. And I'll just use this slide as a basis. Afterwards, the DG will take you through the rest of the slides. Chairperson, the President in the State of the Nation is there, said very clearly that jobs is the focus for our country for this year and for the foreseeable future. He also said that we want to be a developmental state and not a welfare state, and that we need our people to have the dignity that comes with jobs, and that we need to grow our economy in an inclusive way in order that all of our people can benefit from the outcomes of any growth and development within our country. We are trying to achieve that in a context, and we tried to point that out yesterday, and some of the numbers will help you to understand that as well, in a world that's going through an immense transition, in a world that is changing in terms of west to east and west to south and east to south. And we need to understand that those changes come with both the risks and opportunities. And we'll try and emphasize the opportunities rather than risks, but be aware that they are risks. So as long as Europe can't sort out how it's going to pay for what is called sovereign risk or sovereign debt, they constitute a risk, not only for themselves, but the rest of the world as well. Each time one of those countries look a bit doubtful about their ability to pay their debt, the markets, as they're called, begin to get worried, and all sorts of nervous impulses are sent around the world. And we have learned that South Africa is not immune from those impulses. Similarly, the events in North Africa are already having an impact on us and the rest of the world. I haven't checked in the last half an hour, but earlier this morning, oil had now climbed to $111. And if that continues, there are going to be significant impacts for us, which we need to calculate carefully and manage equally carefully as well in a practical sense. But let's focus on the opportunities. The opportunities are that other parts of the world are growing, that multipolarity is becoming a reality, and that if we get our act together, if we can sort out not just the content of the growth path, but the implementation thereof, if we can get the united effort between business, labor, civil society, and government, and get a common focus on what we need to achieve, and spend more time now on effective implementation of some of the ideas that we are talking about, then we will be able to seize those opportunities that avail themselves to us. And that doesn't happen in a neutral environment, which is often what we think. The countries throughout the world, including in the emerging market camp, every one of them are competing with each other. Every one of them wants to sell their products in the world market as well. Every one of them believes that their products are better, cheaper, and more accessible than the next one. And what we as South Africans need to ask is, how are we going to make our products better, cheaper, of equal or not, or better quality? And how are we going to add more muscle to our ability to market what South Africans produce in a way in which we could sell more for it, because that's what exports means at the end of the day, amongst other things. So it's a highly competitive world out there. And the growth path begins to create a framework within which we can ask ourselves, how do we create a more competitive economy? And how do we move forward? Because we're not just saying, I have X, would you like to buy it? There are others who are offering X as well. We need to be aware of that context. The budget, certainly on the expenditure side, Chairperson, indicates very clearly where our money is going. If you assemble all of the numbers, approximately 150 billion rand goes to job creation and training activities and skills development in our economy. And a lot of the focus is about young people. And let me say at the outset that too much is being made about the youth wage subsidy. That is one idea on how we solve a massive problem in this country. We need 100 such ideas. We need all sections of our society to say, this is our idea about how we think we could tackle this problem. And the Jobs Fund is there in order to provide government's part of the support, whilst others also come to the party in terms of how we can tackle some of these issues. So the key issue here, Chairperson, is where are all these ideas and how do we generate them? Secondly, how do we process them in a very constructive and consensual way? And more importantly, how do we put some of these ideas on the ground and get things going sooner rather than later? You will find that, as the slide indicates, that lots of the programs in the growth path are supported, whether it's education, health, skills development, and allocations to various departments to prosecute their programs as well. Infrastructure, once again, and you'll see a slide on this later, is the focus. And it's important to remember that this is not anything new. It's part of a 10-year commitment already that South Africa has made in the past period, but also hopefully a commitment about the next 20 years in terms of what we need to do. And so infrastructure investment plays a key part in what we do. And how we use our fiscal resources is going to be a critical factor. In other words, how much do we put into investing in infrastructure? How much do we put into supporting social services? What do we put into job creation initiatives? What do we use as a percentage for paying salaries and other benefits of public servants? And how do we put this package together is part of the balancing act that you see in the documentation before you. The second last point I want to address before I hand over to the DG is how are we managing the fiscal environment. It is true that our deficit projections are slightly higher than what we said we would get or put on the table in terms of the MTBPS. But let me assure honourable members that as the revenue picture improves, as the economy begins to grow, and it certainly is on a growth trajectory, and it's that trajectory that we need to utilize and that momentum that we need to build on in order to seize the opportunities that are internal to our country, let alone external to our country. So as you, your committee chairperson had asked, how are we going to get a sustainable fiscal path as we go forward? So the beginnings of that conversation are in the documentation that you've seen and in the speech yesterday, which is saying that let's talk about the fiscal principles and fiscal guidelines, and let's have a conversation both within Parliament and outside, and over a period of time, sooner rather than later, let's create a framework which all of us accept is the framework we're working with based on countercyclicality. And we then have some certainty about the parameters within which we want to work. But the key element is South Africa is still engaging in what the G20 calls growth-friendly fiscal consolidation. We have not implemented any austerity measures that other parts of the world have implemented. We hope that we can, with the cooperation of all parties, political and otherwise, pursue a fiscal path that will never require us to implement the austerity measures of Greece, Ireland, and other countries. But look at those countries, because those are useful, real warning signs of what could go wrong if we don't do the right thing. And you have the assurance from our side that government as a whole wants to do the right things in this particular regard and continue to signal that we want to narrow this deficit. As we've always told you, There's no guarantee that there is not going to be a next crisis, because there will be another crisis. That's the nature of what is politely called the business cycle. If you're wearing red, like the honorable member here, you'll call it something else, and then say that's a capitalist crisis, or a crisis of capitalism. But it's true. These things happen. And what we need to do is to prepare for those crises and make sure, just as we had that slight surplus that helped us through this particular recession and financial crisis, that the next one, when and if it comes, and you don't know how and when it is going to happen, we are equally prepared to deal with that crisis as well. But the last point is, Chairperson, I think we have a mixture of policies that are beginning to come together for South Africa. A set of policies that will result in greater investment in our economy from both business and government, a set of policies that will increase job absorption and creation within our economy, policies which this time hopefully will be implemented a lot more assertively in terms of microeconomic changes that need to take place, policies that will ensure that we maintain macroeconomic stability in a very shaky world at the moment, because these oil prices and food prices and other exogenous factors, as these economists will call it, are factors that could be very disruptive as we go forward. And we need to maintain stability so that we give everybody certainty on our side. And policies which build on skills and research and development within our economy as well. The challenge for us now is to get quick consensus, if you like, and implement some of the things that we've been talking about so that we could really move towards 7% growth over a 20-year period. So I'm going to hand over to the Director General to take you through the rest of the slides, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. And Chair, I will go through this presentation pretty quickly. I must apologize if it's longer than what you are normally used to. Just in summary, that we see the economy continue to strengthen and recover. GDP is expected to rise to 3.4% this year and to 4.4% by the outer year of the MTF. We also expect a recovery in revenue and a moderate growth in public spending. A combination of these two would then lower the fiscal deficit. The deficit declines from 5.3% in the 2011-2012 fiscal year and down to 3.8% by the 2013-2014 fiscal year. Government's net debt stabilizes at 40% of GDP in 2013-2014. Net debt here is basically government's gross debt less any cash that government holds. Expenditure rises by 94.1 billion relative to the baseline over MTEF, and the allocations are informed by the government's 12 outcomes, with priority being given to education, health, infrastructure, and job creation. Job creation, especially for young people. Over the next 3 years, there's a total of 150 billion rand that goes towards job creation and skills development programs. And just over 800 billion will be going into infrastructure. So that is the budget in summary. Of course, in setting out this thing, we have to set out what we see as a macroeconomic environment over the next 3 years. We talked about growth earlier on. Inflation remains below 6%, which means that it is within the targeted band of 3 to 6% over the MTF. The private investment and employment recovers gradually. We know that employment does lag GDP growth, but we are beginning to see the economy creating jobs. As we expand our investment program and the economy recovers, we expect that the current account deficit will widen. As we grow, we expect demand to accelerate and imports to rise, and a combination of those two result in the current account deficit widening. The forecast is also taking place within a context of an improved global outlook as emerging market economies grow strongly. The strong global growth, which has been driven by emerging markets, and we tend to characterize this as a two-speed recovery, growth strong in the emerging markets, and although there is recovery in the developed markets, that growth is still fragile. Growth in the developed markets is fragile due to high unemployment, there is a risk of deflation. Many of the developed countries are now fiscally vulnerable. They had to bail out their banking sectors. Because we were in recession, they had to put special stimulus, and putting those stimulus had put them now in fiscal positions that could be characterized as vulnerable. We're also now seeing inflation starting to rear its ugly head, and we are seeing the risk that there is a risk of overheating in emerging markets. We have seen food prices beginning to rise. South Africa, fortunately, was cushioned over the past few months by a stronger and stable currency. But that environment now is different. Oil, as the minister had said, has now hit $111. The fast growth of emerging markets meant that they are also increasing their share in global contribution to global growth, and this is leading to the rebalancing that we had been looking for. And what the table there on the left just shows you how the rankings had changed over time, and now China is the second largest economy in the world. Still, even if China is the second largest economy in the world, it still accounts for less than half of the size of the U.S. Economy. We have also seen a robust and durable expansion in sub-Saharan Africa, which has become important for us as a country, since we do send a lot of manufactured exports into sub-Saharan Africa. This regional growth has been driven by high commodity prices and strong Chinese demand for these commodities. There is also the issue of infrastructure development and cheap global financing that has been driving this growth. And for sub-Saharan Africa, a thing or two that we could show the rest of the world is that there has been prudent management of the macro economy in sub-Saharan Africa. And we also have the advantage of young and growing populations in sub-Saharan Africa. The minister has just passed me a note to say that the thing is the markets are so volatile. The oil price has now reached 118. It was 111 this morning. Yeah. So we might have to join up and be in lift club. There is also the thing that this growth in sub-Saharan Africa, we're going to have to focus on boosting regional trade. And what is it that we would do in boosting regional trade? The BBSA plans to invest some 3.9 billion rand to improve startup infrastructure, especially in the energy and transport sector, and that there are also discussions of an enlarged regional free trade area. There's going to be a summit where SADC, the East African Community, and COMESA would meet to talk about how to facilitate a free flow of goods in sub-Saharan Africa. I talked earlier on about the strong commodity gains. These strong commodity gains support exports, but they also push up import costs and inflation. In our case, I think that this is a safer statement to say the oil price is above $100 a barrel. If we use that, it would mean that the oil price had risen by 33% since July last year. We've seen that feeding itself into international food prices. Food prices are also 37% up compared to June last year. So the prices of South Africa's main export commodities remain high and have been supported by strong demand in China. That commodity prices are always a double-edged sword for South Africa. When commodity prices go up, yes, we benefit from higher platinum price and all of that, but we also have to pay more for the oil that we import. This picture here just once again confirms what has been driving inflation. CPI inflation is projected to rise gradually to average 4.9% in 2011, and we are seeing a rising contribution from food and petrol. The CPI food index is up 2.4% month on month in January, and the petrol price has been up by 11.6% since September 2010. And the weakening currency might actually also boost import prices. Again, when I was in the committee last year, we were complaining about the strong rand and how it's going to hit our export sectors, and now this time round, the currency has weakened. It's feeding itself into inflation for both food and fuel. So it's a volatile environment that we are in. I talked earlier about the fact that there is a tentative sign of investment recovery. The investment ratio, that is investment as a percentage of GDP, had fallen from 20% in the third quarter, had fallen to 20% in the third quarter of 2010 from a peak of 24.6% in the fourth quarter of 2008. We are seeing low capacity utilization and uncertainty that might be deterring investment, but we are seeing tentative signs of recovery as companies are starting to invest again, especially in mining and transport. There's a gradual recovery that is expected as capacity utilization rises and the demand strengthens, which has been supported by the low interest rate environment that we have seen. There has been some delay in SOE investment that we are expecting, but this will also be coming on stream later, thus underpinning investment going forward. As I had said earlier, the question that we have to ask ourselves is what then happens? The economy is recovering. What is happening on the job front? We are seeing stabilization of the labor market with jobs created mainly in the services sector. There's been 157,000 jobs that were created in the fourth quarter of 2010, and we are seeing a gradual recovery in most sectors and the bottoming out of job losses in manufacturing and construction, which suggests that a moderate improvement in the job market will occur during 2011. The burden of unemployment falls disproportionately on young people. Youth unemployment is acute. More than half of 15 to 24 year olds are jobless. So the employment of young people aged between 15 and 24 has declined by about 22%, that is 355,000 over the last 2 years. This is 40% of all job losses in this period. So 40% of job losses that took place had an impact on young people. So what was the response? There is a package of measures for job creation and skills development. We outlined those again in the budget yesterday. It's a list. I should not then for you with that detail. As I said earlier on, we talked about what has been happening with the currency. We've seen a moderation of rand strength since MGBPS. The rand had strengthened by 12% in 2010, but has already weakened by about 10% since December. We have seen a moderation of capital inflows due to global factors. Actually, in the last three months of 2010, we actually saw outflows rather than inflows of capital into South Africa. We had to respond to the nature of the flows that we had through domestic policies. At the time of the MGBPS, we said that we will continue to support the South African Reserve Bank to purchase reserves. And we had also said that what matters in managing capital flows is not just how much money has come in. What matters is what the net position is. So we had allowed South African institutions to also take money out, and that sort of like cancelled the impact of the capital flows on the South African financial market. And we did that through the exchange control reform. There will continue to be a monitoring of measures to offset the impact of capital inflows on currencies. And this has become an international phenomenon. Hardly any international meeting is complete unless people also, without people raising the issue of how do you cope with capital flows. This slide here just shows you what different countries have done in terms of capital management, capital account management. They use different tools, and why did they use it? So times when people say that, well, you must do what that country has done, ask yourself, what was the objective of that country? And we are giving there, that is all the countries that we had looked at and the measures that they had taken to cope with the capital flow. We had also released yesterday proposals to safeguard the financial sector from future crisis. This has been captured in a discussion document titled "A Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better." Essentially, what that paper proposes is a twin peak model of regulation. Consolidation of a prudential regulation in the South African Reserve Bank to ensure systemic stability, and then let the Financial Services Board focus on the issues of consumer protection and market conduct. There are other issues that we are dealing with in that paper, which also include the issues of access to financial services. Now that we know the environment that we in, how does the consolidated government fiscal framework look like over the next 3 years? We have seen improvements that I have seen, which has been driven by a recovery in the revenue in line with the economy. I have seen a stabilization in non-interest spending that averages an annual real growth of 2.8% over the MTF. Again, this table was in the budget review yesterday. There is no need for me to repeat it. We talked about the additions to baseline of 94.1 billion over the MTF. Over this period, we are seeing compensation of employees rising by an average of 6.6% per annum. This is not the salary increase that public servants are going to get. This is simply an increase in the salary bill of the government. So it includes any additional people that government is going to employ. We have seen real transfers to households that have been growing by 3.2% per annum, and we have seen real interest costs rise by 11.4% per annum. The change in debt service costs, this is now the fastest growing area of expenditure for the government. So the fiscal stimulus that we had was not for free. It comes with a cost, and the cost you see with debt service cost. Now, what is important, I mean, I said that I should not be spending too much time on graphs, but this one is particularly important for the discussion that we are going to have about the fiscal sustainability. You could see that on the panel on the left, that debt service cost used to be our saving grace. Because we were running a tight fiscal ship, we were bringing down debt service costs, and we could utilize that money and allocate it to other areas of government expenditure. Now, as the panel on the right shows you, you can see that debt service costs are rising rapidly, rising faster than the rate of compensating employees, rising faster than the transfer to households. It's even rising faster than our payment for capital assets. So the path that we have set of fiscal consolidation over the next 3 years becomes particularly important because we have got to arrest that picture. The public sector infrastructure spending that is worth 808 billion over the MTEF, What we have there is a split for each one of the sectors. I will not get that into that much of detail. Suffice to say that of that amount, 392 billion, or just 49% of the spending, is by non-financial public enterprises, predominantly Eskom, Transnet, South African National Roads Agency. Provinces and municipalities remain significant drivers of spending, in spite of what we have seen, that the most recent figures actually showed that they are below budget in terms of their spending. That 82% of this spending is in economic services such as power plant construction, the transport network, sanitation and water infrastructure, and that this spending on capital, on infrastructure, averages 8.4% of GDP over the MTEF. The infrastructure program also then brings to us the importance of development finance institutions and the strategic role that they have to play in meeting government growth objectives. The asset base of the major DFIs amount to 153 billion rand, with a lending capacity of around 115 billion over the next 3 years. There are initiatives to create or enhance their capacity. The development bank, there has been a proposal to increase the callable capital to 20 billion rand, and directing the IDC to leverage up to 70 billion rand on their healthy balance sheet. The recapitalization of the land bank continues. The National Housing Financing Corporation will borrow 500 million rand from multilateral development agencies, and that leveraging on infrastructure grants to reduce the risk of lending to municipalities that are credit risk. That is what the DFIs are supposed to assist us filling in that space. So there will be further assistance, which will be subject to successful and effective implementation of strategies to increase the existing lending capacity, leverage the DFIs to assist the departments with the rollout and implementation of capital expenditure projects, particularly in the health and education sector, and lastly, the creation of a DFI council, which will enhance coordination, give strategic guidance, and monitoring the delivery by the DFIs. Now, that infrastructure program, as we have said, would have to be funded, and we have captured that in the public sector borrowing requirements. This is a very important indicator, because earlier on, as I was talking about rise in debt service costs, if you are to bring down debt service costs, you are going to have to bring down your borrowing over time. Public sector borrowing requirement declined from a high of 10.5% of GDP in 2010-2011 to 6.3% by 2013-2014. And this comes as a result of the narrowing of the consolidated government deficit and lower borrowing by non-financial public enterprises, as they start to rely more on their own revenue stream coming into line over this period. Chair, we talked earlier that these issues raise the questions of fiscal sustainability, and the committee did ask us to go back and look at the long-term issues of fiscal sustainability. One key measure of fiscal sustainability is what we have called the primary balance. The primary balance here is the difference between budget revenue and non-interest expenditure. In other words, before we pay for the debt that we had accumulated, what resources are available before us? It's a very important indicator, that the primary balance. So non-interest spending rose strongly during the boom period, thanks to very robust revenue. But as that picture shows us, we were not as rich as we thought we were, because that revenue was cyclical. And that is why you see that widening of the gap between the red line and the gray line. The red line is non-interest expenditure, and you could see it was rising whilst budget revenue was declining. And over the MTF, we are bringing down the non-interest expenditure to make sure that we are restoring our primary balance. There is a stabilization of non-interest spending and higher revenue that would contribute to the reduction of the primary budget deficit from 4.3% in 2009-10 to 0.9% of GDP in 2013-14. That is what we are going to have to do if we are to stabilize that picture of debt service cost. The other indicator of fiscal sustainability is the actual level of the debt. The counter-cyclical fiscal stance has led to increased borrowing to meet expenditure commitments. So debt service costs are rising during the MTEF. Again, debt service costs lack the reduction in borrowing. So the fact that you are bringing down your borrowing, you will only see the benefits of lower borrowing a year, two, 3 years down the line. So net debt stabilizes at 40% of GDP in 2016. It's not a level which should cause us to lose sleep, but it is something that we are going to have to watch very closely if we are to release the resources through bringing down the cost of servicing state debt. The guarantees for state-owned enterprises also increased from 63 billion rand in 2008-09 to 194 billion in 2013-14. This had been provided in order to reduce the borrowing costs of the SOEs, particularly those of ESCOM. So what the panel there just shows you, the line there is the net loan debt and is measured on the right side of the axis, and the gross loan debt is measured on the left side of the crisis. And those are the amounts, that's about 1.3 trillion rand in debt that we would have during this period. So, we have the indicators of what fiscal sustainability is. What this committee and parliament asked us was that we have got to take this thing further, and we are thus having to come to you with this proposal to protect our fiscal gain and those of future generations. We will require a fiscal framework. We will require a framework that is based on long-run levels of expenditure and revenue that the economy can afford. So what we are having, the situation that we are having now with the debt level that we have, is that we are borrowing, and if we do not bring that under control, we are leaving that legacy for our children and their children's children. So we might live comfortably today and leave the burden of servicing our excesses of today with generations that come. So what do we propose? We propose that we should adopt an annual target for the structural balance that will be consistent with long-term growth, the desired level of public debt, and intergenerational consideration. Now, I've shown you that picture that shows that we have revenue, and we, during that time, we felt richer than we actually were. So we thought that that revenue that we had was a permanent feature. It was not a permanent feature. It was of a cyclical nature. And what this indicator, the structural budget balance, does is that it estimates what revenue is of a temporary nature, and then say, let us save that for a rainy day. We're also proposing that we make explicit the cost of existing and new programs that require long-term expenditure commitments. There are some of the government programs that commitments that we make. The expenditure gets felt for years to come, including the social policies that we commit to. The cost will be felt for as long as those policies are in place, and we are saying that we are going to have to make those costs explicit. that could suggest that we would have to take into account issues such as demography, for example. What's going to happen if we are making commitments to pensions, for example? What's going to happen when the demography changes? Will there be enough younger people in the future to meet that obligation, or should you have some form of pre-funding of those commitments? Thirdly, we are proposing that we set out a timeline to bring the budget back on budget balance back on target following large fiscal shocks. So we had to have a fiscal stimulus 2 years ago because the economy was in recession. And what we are proposing is that if we say we are giving a stimulus because the economy is in recession, we must also set out a path that says how quickly will we restore that balance. So the structural budget balance target should support the macroeconomic objective of the new growth path by promoting lower interest rates and stability. Put simply, government is the premium borrower in the domestic capital market. If government goes to borrow money, investors will choose to lend money to government before they lend to anybody else. So if government goes and borrows everything that exists out there, all that government will be doing is crowd everybody out of the capital market and push the cost of borrowing. So if we are to have lower long-term rates in the future, we are going to have to reduce government borrowing over the MTF. And that is how we are going to have to support the growth path. And lastly, over the long term, economic stability will contribute to higher growth and protect the prosperity of our children. We talked about the tax estimates. I think that we've captured this thing very well when we set out that fiscal framing. Suffice to say that tax revenue estimates for 2010-2011 are up 73.5 billion compared to 2009-10. They are also 24 billion rand above the 2010 budget estimate, but they are 7 billion rand below what we estimated at the time of the MTBPS. That 7 billion rand, unless my colleague Opa Makashula finds the money over the next 1.5 months, we are going to have to borrow that money. No, Commissioner, it's not a threat. It's just a humble request from a veteran of the budget. there are the tax proposals. I don't think, Chair, I should go through those proposals. They are self-evident. There aren't big tax changes. I think that the one that I must highlight is the one the second bullet from the bottom, that taxation of gambling. Fortunately, people in the Treasury don't gamble, because if they gamble, they wouldn't be working in the Treasury in the first place. So we just highlighted that. There are issues around business taxes and indirect taxes, which we had highlighted as well yesterday. I think that an important issue is the issue of the social security overview, what we have done in terms of changes to the state old age grant and allowing putting an additional increase for those above 75. My colleague said to me yesterday, because my old man was here, how old is your old man? And I said he is 77. They thought that this thing coincided with the fact that my old man had gone above 75, but it has nothing of that sort. I think the important thing here, for Chair, is that the government's social security reform discussion paper is now going through the government processes and will now be released for a public consultation, including discussion in NEDLAC. This is the government spending and division of revenue. The session in the afternoon will be going into detail with that. I will not bore you with that. Just to re-emphasize that government's main new spending plans over the MTEF have concentrated in the main in job creation, in education and skills development, and in health services. There are, of course, also the area of housing and community amenities, social protection, and economic affairs. This is the detail that I do not think that I think that it is well captured in the document. And then, of course, the provincial and local government spending plans, which will also be dealt with when you do the division of revenue. That, Chair, is my attempt to reduce into a few slides 1,290 pages of the budget document that we tabled yesterday.
Director General, Mr. Chakanya, you have given us an assurance that you won't meet any of your employees in either Carousel or Mirupa. If we meet them, they'll be in the right sections of the casino. Thank you. Over to you, Sean.
And thank you very much. Thank you to the Minister. Thank you to the Minister, thank you, Minister, and the Director General, and the rest of the team that will be answering the questions from now on, honorable members. There you have it. What is also important is the reply by the Minister in National Treasury to the questions that was put forward to Treasury and is captured in the budget review document from page 133. Until 138. It's very important that you look at that as well as the tax expenditure statement, page 136. That is the first time that we have that information as well. Honourable members, put up your hands. Let me note you. Please introduce yourself when you ask your question. I'm starting here in front of me.
Then the second issue and the last one, Chair,
is a clarion call to the minister to say, if we are in a country like South Africa, which is dominated by young people, and the focus is much more on the development of that category of people, but with the lack of sport and recreation facilities in the rural areas, I don't think we are responding more on that aspect, taking into consideration that the budgets that are located at provincial sports, art and culture departments is so small that even the leveling of a playing ground cannot be done at that level. I would suggest a situation whereby, Honourable Minister, that the location of the municipal infrastructure grant that is actually intended to develop sport and recreational facilities be where the mandate of sport development is, and that is the Department of Minister Mbalula. Because as of now, this mandate is seemingly an unfunded one when you get into the local authorities, where if that is located within the MIG, it is not a priority. The municipalities will say, how do you prioritize sport when people are crying for water and roads? Because it is part of infrastructure that they need to look after. But the question of sport and recreation is seemingly lingering about where there is no meager funding intended for that purpose, and also as a legacy of 2010 World Cup, as well as a rural development initiative. Thank you, sir.
Dr. Onbo Matlamini.
Thank you, Chair. I think one needs to first acknowledge and appreciate Honourable Minister, through your Chair, the response, especially on the recommendations or the concerns that they were raised by the committee. We really appreciate that, and we are aware that when we say things, you take them seriously and you do something about it. We really appreciate that. And having said that, Honourable Minister, there are circumstances that we cannot change. We are aware of them. We have just mentioned them. One of them is to make sure that our country have a competitive economy and the exchange rate. As a result, we see the Reserve Bank purchasing $53 billion, trying to control that part. But I still strongly believe, Honourable Minister, that we have not yet, as a country, utilize the opportunity within the regional trade. And as a result, today, there is this volatility that you don't know what to do with it because of the oil. And what is there to cushion that, we are not too sure. And I don't think we do have the formula to that for now. So I suggest or propose, Mr. Minister, because during the presentation from your department and some of the team, we have picked up that, you know, if we can have very effective processes and systems on the implementation, on what we've got, we put those processes in place. Taking for an example, you'll find that some of the departments, they don't even submit the performance indicators, but the money gets allocated. You sit and ask yourself, what is the division of M&E doing? Because they are supposed to submit those things. Are you failing to do that? Do you see us as the committee assisting you? If so, how? Because we need to have those selected performance indicators before the money gets allocated. Because without that, as a committee, we won't be able to do the proper oversight. And the implementation thereof then, of the fiscal, it will create an unbalanced fiscal environment. Lastly, I look through the allocation to the statistician general. I was a bit worried, Honorable Minister, bearing in mind that they are about to conduct the census 2011. And if you can just convince me that it is enough, it was catered for, I'll be happy. Because I come from the province where sometimes you don't even need a horse. You actually need a sleep, you know it, to go down and reach the people. Thank you.
The Honourable Member next to Honourable Majumin.
The first question I want to ask is, I see on page 3 of the speech, there is a point there which says savings have been identified on low priority categories of spending, releasing over 30 billion to frontline service delivery allocation. Which areas? Are they the same areas which were identified in 2009? And is there national coordination on these areas of cost containment? Because I get a sense that when we say that we have gone to a pastry or recession, people then go back to their normal things of frivolous expenditure, organizing meetings, even if they've got our facilities, they go to hotels, lodges, even if the department have facilities which have been spent, people have spent. So it's the issue of national coordination. Secondly, do we have, what is the assessment of the department on financial management capacity across the three spheres? Because we always talk about local government having difficulties of financial management capacity, but each political term, people who work in government at provincial level and at national level, we change them like underwear. And there's no stability. New people coming, and well, the National Treasury has got a lot of people who have been working there for quite some time. That's not the picture in other departments. People have, some of them started their assistant directors, they became directors, chief directors, DDGs. They rose within the ranks of the treasury. But across the country, what is the assessment? Because this issue for us is an issue which worries. That's why in our province, most of the people who work in treasury have been with treasury for quite some time. There was no like changes of people all willy-nilly. Because of this issue of follow-up and ensuring that you also assist municipalities to manage their finances properly. And I'm not saying that people who are not doing their work should be kept, but I'm just, the area of, when we talk about stability in the market, but there must also be stability in how we manage our public service. So I would congratulate the Treasury on that issue. The other one is the question of how do we manage the fears linked to the business community not managing the youth employment subsidy properly. Because the issue in the speech is discussion, but obviously we cannot discuss forever. But the fear has been that, well, once people don't meet, but the very people who came in through youth subsidy will be retrenched at some point by the business sector. How do we manage that issue? Or maybe if the discussions are, will be handled there, I'll accept it that some of the issues are at net length. But the management of the fears of the misuse of the youth subsidy, particularly from the trade union movement and community sector, that could be a problem. But obviously the issue of youth unemployment is a very, very serious problem. And as a country, we have to take dramatic means because the fear is that some people will not even have employment for the rest of their life if we don't take dramatic measures. And it can be that people will finish school or a university, they will never work until they become adults. And then we have to then deal with the issue of permanent grant. But I also agree that grant should be a measure we take so that people have, in the meantime, while we're trying to skill, get people into work. And then the last one is that, what is our assessment of, because we said that people have to be given skills and put into employment. Now, part of the the new growth path, and it was to talk about getting people into full-time employment. But do we monitor? Because the sense you get is that even the people who are putting on expanded public works program would not be your people. Some of them will not be your people who are getting child support grants. We go and look for people who are new and put them onto expanded public works program. We don't get people who are already, we have their names, we have everything, who should be there. But then the people will say, well, the person gets the grant. But the sense of how do we people exit the grant if they are going to be in full-time employment? Because I don't buy this notion that people will be there, therefore, the issue I'm actually wanting to ask there is the close monitoring of ensuring that people who are on the grant system get onto programs which give them capacity to be able to get onto a job. It might be 5-year jobs, it might be permanent jobs, so that new people can come in. And until there's a sense that there's coordination, not only treasury, public works, health, education, all the areas where expanded public works is happening, particularly phase two, then people will be correct to say that people will be on grants forever. And the minister yesterday said that we need to have people graduating out of, but knowing that there is a place where they are going to actually go. But overall, we think for our province we'll be able to, with the new statistics, we are currently the biggest in terms of number.
Please, we must look at our time. We've got time until 12:45. Keep to the point when you raise your question. But the Honourable Member was here with a mandate from his province, so he just did that. Honourable Swart?
Yeah, I haven't got a mandate from my province yet, Chair. I'm still to talk with him, but just two quick questions. The one was raised by the Honourable Member, and that is about the EPWP. You know, at the moment, the under-expenditure on EPWP is serious. It is, I think, in the region of something like 800 million. Are we putting any plans in place to make sure that the EPWP funds are spent and they are spent properly and that they are controlled and that the jobs are actually created by that fund? That's the first question. Second question, Chair, is in the budget speech, the Minister referred to the introduction of a mandatory basic retirement service plan, which we welcome. We have not a problem with that. But and in the same one, he also proposed taxing the employer contribution as a fringe benefit. And I'm wondering whether those two don't contradict each other. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. First, just a general comment and then a short question. I think the Honourable Minister in his budget speech mentioned that our energy needs at the moment is very much dependent on fossil fuels, and our CO2 emissions are a reason for grave concern. I think, and that's a number of the other BRIC countries have got the same problem. But the Honourable Minister also mentioned that 800 million has been set aside over the next 3 years for the development of a green economy. I'd like to have more clarity on what would it entail, and what is the most important one? Where are we going to start off in the first year? Because we have profound problems. I'm just thinking of acid water and so forth, which might be detrimental to the economy as a whole. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Marais.
Thank you very much, Chair. My first question is on the allocation to the National Youth Development Agency, which deals with job creation and stimulating the economy, over R1 billion over the next 3 years. I don't want to use the phrase, how on earth will they assist us? But I mean, you know, how will that be done? How will that be unpacked? We know how they've spent over R1 million now, R100 million now on a huge party. How will this over R1 billion over the next 3 years be utilized to stimulate real job creation? There's no information, and there's huge doubts whether that will be money well spent.
The next thing about job creation as well. Minister, we know we need 7% GDP per year over the next 10 years to create 5 million jobs. New jobs. Not just jobs, new jobs. You've indicated a GDP of 3.4% for this year, growing to 4.4% in 2013. It seems like these figures don't match. So you're still mentioning that your objective is to grow to 5 million jobs, new jobs in 2020. How do you match these? And how will that difference be made up? How will we get to the 5 million jobs? Because these figures doesn't support that. Then in terms of the National Growth Path support, we know that the only way that we can distribute more money and appropriate more money is by broadening our tax base, our revenue base. Now, you talked about the real support. There's only a few items that is new to me in terms of the new growth path. So a lot of the things is what was in the previous budget as well. It was just not under the new growth path. So what is really new to support private sector, to stimulate the economy, to grow the economy, and to create more jobs? Because in your documents, you quite clearly said that you must have the buy-in of the private sector who can really grow the economy and create the jobs. I don't see that. The other concern that I've got in terms of job creation, or at least containing what we've got in the agricultural sector, it is one of the pillars of the new growth path, that agri-industries, agri-processing can create jobs and can create stimulation. Now, from own experience, and I've attended the Agri-SA conference the other day, and the two ministers gave a fantastic speech and a message to the farmers. You talk about the 19 million rand on the one hand, but on the other side, you're increasing the so-called sin tax. Now, the liquor industry can be seen as a sin, but in terms of the contribution to GDP and in the effect of that has got on employment and growing the agricultural side is really a huge burden. And I'm trying to draw the parallel between increases that as a way of getting extra revenue, but on the other hand, supporting the agricultural side to grow the economy and to stimulate more jobs. And the message that I get from the agri side is contrary to what maybe you believe that will do. So what is your view on how will that really help the whole economy to grow? Thank you very much.
I just want to give Somadi an opportunity.
Yeah, no, just to assist in terms of trying to phrase our questions to National Treasury because of time, and I don't want to censure honorable members. But as we pose this question, one of the things that we should bear in mind is that what is the role of Parliament in ensuring that which the Minister has elaborated on in terms of resource allocation, what is our role? For instance, if we talk about understanding in the EPWP program, that's information that we get from National Treasury. It comes forward. The question that we should also be posing to ourselves as Parliament is, what have we done with that particular issue? So I just wanted to make sure that we don't ask questions that we ourselves should be providing answers as we move on.
And honourable members must also bear in mind, this is the budget for the country. Every department is noted here. Every minister, cabinet minister, will table that department's budget in Parliament. And that's an opportunity to engage with that specific minister and that department, and it's open meeting, so you are free to go and attend the Ministers of Agriculture's budget and ask the agriculture questions, because I'm going there. I've got serious issues in agriculture in my constituency. Dr. George.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Minister, and your team for the presentation. On the wage subsidy, we are very pleased to see that there is some progress on this, but it certainly seems from your speech that it still is a proposal and there needs to be a lot of discussion on it. So my question to you is, will it be implemented, Minister, and when? Then on the expansionary stance, I agree that it was necessary to relax the deficit, but of course the purpose of additional spending is to stimulate the economy so that it can have economic growth, the jobs that come with it, and then of course revenue would be generated, which would then not require any increases to taxation. But Minister, you're talking about possible increases in tax despite the stimulation that you're doing to the economy. So I'm just wondering whether you are convinced enough about whether your spending interventions are sufficient to generate the economic growth that will generate the revenue that will then mitigate against the need for tax increases. Because obviously if spend is done in the correct places to accelerate economic growth, we won't have that problem. It also relates to the question put by Mr. Marais, where we were looking at 3.6% projected or expected growth. I think it's now 3.4, so it seems to be going the wrong way. So I'd like an answer on that. And then finally, thank you very much for your response on our question from Parliament on the VAT on books. But you didn't answer the question. The question was what the impact of a zero rating on books would be on the fiscal framework. Now, you didn't answer that question. Treasury went into some detail on why they do not support this proposal, but that wasn't the question. The question is what is the impact on the fiscal framework? That would be a number. So we would like to see that, because I would like to remind you that we passed the Money Bills Amendment and Related Matters Act, which says that Parliament can, in fact, amend the budget. So if it decides that it wants to take off that on books and or other things, it can actually do that, and the process would include then Treasury giving its opinion on whether it should or shouldn't. But we didn't ask that question. It was about the impact on the fiscal framework. So I'd like to know when we are actually going to get an answer to that. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Kurnov.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation, Minister and DG. Can I say I fault yesterday the debt servicing costs and the state wage bill, the terrible twins. Now, I'm very pleased to see the guidelines for fiscal sustainability in your presentation, and I'm feeling quite comfortable with regard to debt servicing costs and where we're going. And I think that's clear for everyone to see. My concern remains, and that is the state wage bill. What can we do to shrink it? And if you balance out that the president has asked now the civil service to fill all vacancies, you know, I will concur that you need to fill vacancies where it will make a difference to service delivery, but just not vacancies for the sake of filling and so-called then create jobs. So I want to ask, is there something we can do, and is it not time to look towards the provinces? But if you look at the percentage of the state wage bill, they are a huge contributor to expenditure there.
The objective will be to get more operational people at grassroots level to implement. Honourable Makubela.
Thank you, Chairperson. Minister, during your opening remarks, you mentioned that now if we get cooperation among the business community, how are you going to get this cooperation? Do you have a strategy in place just to get them involved so that they can assist you in managing and monitoring this budget? Number two, it is in connection with the skills. We talk about the skills time and again. Can we say with certainty that, no, here are jobs created that are available? It's only a particular skill, which is scarce skills, which that person cannot be employed on a particular job. If we can say that, can the minister say we have particular jobs, but we lack this particular skill? Thank you, Minister.
Professor Turok?
Thank you. An excellent document this morning, and it indicates that veterans are still useful even in the Treasury. So you're welcome to for your presentation. I heard the minister on the After Eight debate this morning, and he answered very effectively the question of the cost of the public service, and I'm sure he's going to give the similar answer here to now. One of the points that came across very strongly was he kept repeating the need for balance. Now, obviously, balance is a hallmark of this budget, but most of us come to the budget with a particular point of departure. And my own point of departure, some people favor social spending, et cetera, et cetera. My own point of departure is growing the real economy. And it seems to me that this is where I would question the statement by the DG that we must reduce government borrowing as if all government borrowing is the same. Government borrowing, as previous speakers have indicated, government borrowing for the real economy produces revenues at a later date, which actually grows the economy in a way that we all want. So it seems to me that reducing government borrowing in general is fine, but reducing it in the real economy, growing the real economy, is a different matter. And it seems to me this debate has been going on for a long time internationally. Growing for the borrowing for the real economy is a different matter to borrowing for other expenditures, and I think we should always distinguish between the two. Which leads me to my actual question, and this is that this morning's Business Day published a little table on the expenditures for the real economy, growing the real economy. They tried to put together five statistics which would indicate to us how this budget actually supports the growth of the real economy. I'd be awfully grateful if the Treasury could do the same thing for us. I've read the documents, and I have some difficulty in pulling out that concentrated data which can satisfy Rob Davies and Patel and myself and others about how the budget is going to expand the real economy in South Africa, let alone all the other considerations. And it seems to me that there is a strong push in the country and in Parliament, that the real economy must get the maximum attention, let alone all the other factors. And it would be helpful if the Treasury could and the Minister could help us in focusing on that particular point at some stage. Thank you.
Both van Rooyen, Niels van Rooyen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got two questions. The one is in the budget review document on page 57, table 4.4, the major infrastructure project. Now, being a Free Stater and a Cheetah supporter, I don't see one project in the Free State there. I want to know why is that like, why is there no major projects in the Free State? As we all know, the Free State has got difficulties with its road transport, road network, especially on maintenance. And Free State has been used by everybody in South Africa to pass through on their way to Cape Town or wherever they're going to. So I'm concerned about that, Honourable Minister, that the Free State is again not on that list. And I just want to know why is that right. The other question is, Chairperson, is the capacity of revenue collection in provinces. Now, we've, and especially in municipalities, and that is a concern. And lately we've heard of the billings problems in the municipalities. We also have some in the smaller municipalities where the billing systems are not up to scratch. That means that municipalities is unable to collect revenue. The example that I normally use is the traffic cop in Boshoff. That only sits in his 1,400 bucky the whole time eating hamburgers. And it doesn't stop nobody. You can drive through bus over 130, no, I will not say 234 kilometers an hour, but 140 you can. And he does not, he sits there and he gets so fat that that he can't even get out of the 1400 bucket. Now, I want to know if Treasury is concerned about this, because revenue collection at... Sorry, can I be protected? Yes,
protect you from this.
Yeah, because municipalities are dependent on the mixed transfers and also the, what do you call it, the other grants that they get from the government. So I just want to know if Treasury is concerned about this revenue collection capacity of municipalities. Thank you.
Yeah, Honourable Van Rooyen, I also travel to through the Northern Cape, and Kimberley is experiencing that high traffic at the moment. Honourable Ramat Lakani.
Thank you, Chair, and of course, with the Treasury, they always very excel on the packaging of this document and the graph. Minister, I note in the section in your speech, you speak about the banks and the regulation of the banks, and I think that haven't checked the response from ordinary South African. It's an excellent point, but it is put very diplomatically in a speech. I was wondering whether there is a program to get to that regulation. If you do get to it, when is it a time frame to get to that regulation? And the second one, quick question on the... There's also one paragraph in a speech that speaks about the funding options for national health insurance, and it raises options. I'm wondering in terms of the time frame for the consultation on options, for when are we going to get involved in that process of engagement on options, whether the list that has been put there is an appropriate or total list of options. The third one, Minister, is the functions. The devolution of delegations of functions, I note metro and public transport is good, but I'm wondering, given the delegations and the money, whether there is a delegation and the money that follows the delegation, and if so, where would that money, where is it going to be located? Is going to come out of the departmental budget? And I know I'm asking that question because I look at rail transport, and I look at the figures that has been associated with the recap of that program. The job creation, and I think we all support that, but there's little detail on the 9 billion that has been mentioned in the budget speech. Perhaps I'm just wondering where we'll get the full detail. Now, I was wondering on this education and training colleges, that the 14 billion, is it over MTEF period, or is it a yearly one? Because it hasn't been clarified on it. The last one, Minister, is on the youth and the unemployment of youth. I note that the age stat that is being used and the graph and the age stat that has been used in the speech are different, but the figures are the same. The one says 15 to 24 and the other one says 18 to 29, but they come to the same. I'm just wondering which one. 15 probably is not necessarily employable age yet. I was just wondering, the job creation comprehensive strategy, the comprehensive strategy, who's holding it together, particularly around the issue of young people? That kind of plan, is it a set X department or a cluster that is holding that together? Otherwise it becomes an issue that we raise, but actually not seeing a total picture. Who holds that together? Thanks.
Honourable Monsisi, and after Honourable Monsisi, Honourable Segoni, then we will give the Minister and his team the opportunity to respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, on page 5 of the presentation, I think it's slide number 10. Here the presentation speaks about the investment. I'm not quite sure whether this is domestic or... Now, they say the investment ratio fell to 20%. And then there are factors under bullet 2, uncertainties that deter the investment. Now, I also wanted to find out if we are talking about domestic or global factors that affect investment. But if we are talking about local here, and then I would like to know the percentage of FDI to South Africa in the period 2009-2010. And also, lastly, Chairperson, the issue of the sustainability of the social development grant. There's no doubt in my mind that the grant is doing very good work in cushioning, you know, the impact of poverty amongst our people. But the issue of sustainability, I would like to find out if the Ministry has made any recommendations or sensitized the Social Welfare Department about innovations which should be taking place in terms of co-ops or whatever. It's more or less along the lines in which my colleague raised the question. But whether there are innovations which have been put into place, we have mooted this issue for quite a long time, just to ensure that in future there would be sustainability. Thank you.
Honorable Shigoni.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and our appreciation to the department, to the minister, and the department for the presentation. The Honorable Kobet Musisi raises the question that also I wanted to raise around the susceptibility of that, but my own question was rather related to the introduction that was made earlier this morning, that of creating, of not creating a welfare state, but from the the budget yesterday, in the past there used to be what we call the development agency that was there to pull people away from to pull people away from the social welfare. But these days I'm not hearing much from it, but I thought that it was it should be a very useful tool to ensure that people can start their own businesses or whatever, or as co-ops or whatever. But I'm not sure if, or perhaps it's catered for in the department, I'm not very sure, but if we could get a clarity on that. Now the last question, Chair, is around the, you know, the report of the DFI. You know, there was some years ago a research that was done around the DFI. I don't know if that report is now ready. Perhaps it can be made available to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. We will now give the opportunity to the Minister and his team to respond. Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Honourable Members for all of the questions. Let me find the beginning. Honourable Lienge asked about where the money for sports facilities should lie. I'm going to ask Mr. Kenneth Brown to address this issue. But, you know, at the end of the day, getting sports facilities going is about how one uses the discretion that one has, not just the money that national government passes on. So each province has the right to change its budgets and align its budgets in a particular way. And that's their choice at the end of the day, whether they want to invest in sports facilities or not. But we will certainly agree with you that this is a key area in terms of social development, in terms of engaging young people, and of building better social cohesion at a local level and elsewhere Dubazana raises questions about us not utilizing opportunities in the region adequately. This is an area that DTI and others are looking at. In the SACU context, for example, we're talking about infrastructure developments, which would be more regionally based. As you know, our president is leading a major Africa North-South project in the AU context as well. We also know that only 10% of trade from Africa happens within the continent itself, and that the logistics infrastructure on the continent and in our region is not what it should be. So there are all sorts of reasons, but we certainly agree with you that a lot more needs to be done to promote trade between South Africa and other African countries and amongst themselves as well. Implementation processes, and we hope that the Ministry of Monitoring and Evaluation, together with the Treasury, because we will get certain financial information and to some extent performance information as well, but as that ministry begins to take off, they will begin to do that work and begin to report transparently on who delivers or not. And both the chairpersons make a very valid point that the Treasury can't account for other departments. We can explain where we know, but that in a sense Parliament as a whole, as you're saying, needs to look at those performance, not just the indicators, but the reports as well, and to indicate whether delivery is actually occurring. Because a lot of our discussion often remains at a policy level, not at the delivery level. And at the delivery level, and I think that's what you're hinting at, we don't quite get tight numbers. So there's a lot of rhetoric and lots of debate about differences and so on, but not enough focus on whether hard targets are actually delivered. And we should look at that element. The allocation to the Statistician General, Mr. Donaldson, will address that in a moment. But as far as we're concerned, it should be adequate because nobody's complained to us yet. Unless somebody's canvassing you, you know. South Africa's parliament is growing now, so canvassing and lobbying is becoming part of our culture. So I must be very frank, Chairperson. I've already smelt it in a few places amongst the questions that have been asked, but we'll get to that in a moment. No, not in your case. So, but there's a few others. We're not so naive as to miss all of that. You can add, the Deputy Minister will add in a moment on some of those issues. Honorable Papa's questions around financial management capacity and his analogy with underwear. Changing underwear is good. Changing financial management frequently isn't. And I think you make a very valid point. So financial management in the public service is a serious issue. In municipalities, there's disastrous appointments that are made. In different provinces, it will vary. Some are excellent, some are not. In different national departments, there will be variations as well. And SCOPA and the Accountant General often look at that, and maybe the committee might want to call the Accountant General at some point in time and look at this in a more pointed way, but you raise a very valid point. But sometimes we blame financial management and financial management capacity for wrong political decisions. So I don't think we must use poor financial management to cover up for decisions that we're making incorrectly or improperly at a political level as well. Managing the youth wage subsidy, remember this is still in a stage of consultation, and it refers to a whole range of colleagues that have asked this question, that there is a paper. That paper will go through further government processes. It will go through NEDLAC processes. And we must be frank, there's disputes around, or other differences that we need to resolve. And there are genuine concerns that youth employed through this kind of mechanism might displace existing workers. Those are genuine concerns. And what we're saying is, can we sit around the table and understand what are the mechanisms through which that might happen? And is it possible to design the subsidy in a way in which that doesn't happen? Because the intention here is not to replace existing workers, but to complement existing workers. Let's be absolutely clear about that. The Treasury can't come up with ideas which results in lower employment in the economy as a whole. I mean, that will be silly in the extreme. The idea here is to bring more people into the job market on some or other basis, and we need to actually work on that and find some solutions. Now, there will be skeptics, and let me repeat, this is one idea. Where are the other ideas? And can we put them on the table? And if need be, we'll withdraw this idea, because there's a better idea that we can actually talk about. But let's not have an absence of ideas and only attacks on one thing. That doesn't help resolve matters and take this serious issue forward. EPWP, whether this is being monitored adequately, and whether people on grants move to jobs, I think that's the new phase that we need to move on to, where there are both monitoring mechanisms, but assistance mechanisms, and if you like, transmission mechanisms, which ensure that where possible, and several of you have raised this question, we can actually move people into jobs and take them off grants, and incentivize people for getting into jobs as well. So that is certainly a direction that we would agree with. Mr. Swart, EPWP and under expenditure, Mr. Brown will take that question to the extent that we can. Again, I refer you to the chairs, and that you should ask for the relevant departments to explain themselves on this matter. Whether there's a contradiction between the mandatory retirement savings plan and taxing employer contributions, Mr. Lowe and Mr. Donaldson will address that, but I think what we are trying to do here is to regularize matters on the tax side, where if there's a principle that fringe benefits should be taxed, then we should try to get that principle implemented on an even-handed basis. And what is happening in this environment in certain quarters is that the employer contribution is quite substantial. And there is no, if you like, harmonization across the system in terms of the deductible part. And that is why we're saying this is a matter that needs careful and further discussion. But the idea is to actually harmonize this particular area. And if there are unintended consequences, then let's understand them and deal with them as well. Mr. Ravi, 800 million rands for the green economy. Again, this is, in some parts, work that is already happening. Colleagues, amongst the officials, Mr. Donaldson and others can look at this, but there's work, for example, going on in the Department of Environment. There's work going on in the Department of Water. There's work going on in science and technology in terms of solar technology. There's work in the Department of Energy. So there's a whole range of areas which are either actual or potential sites of development. And there's work going on through Minister Patel's ministry as well in this area. But we'll see how we can assist with the information that we have in this area. The NYDA and how job creation will be done. I don't know. All we know is that they have presented proposals, some of which have been accepted through the budgetary process. But again, if the officials have any more information, let's deal with that. That's Mr. Malay's question. Apparent conflict, as you call it, between the 4% growth and 5 million jobs. This is a story we've been telling since last year. that if we continue, and the data was in Chapter 3 last year, the employment chapter of the budget review, that this is the gap that we want to fill. That if we continue on 4% growth, we will not meet the kind of employment pressures and targets that we have. That we do need to increase the growth levels in our economy. And we do need to do the kind of extraordinary things that the growth path is suggesting and the various departments are taking on as their responsibilities. So it's certainly our aspiration to both grow the economy and grow jobs and reduce inequality in our society. Now we've got to put the instruments together which will actually enable us to do so. And you're right. I mean, some of the areas of the growth path, if you say agriculture is going to be around for the last 100 years and hopefully for the next 100 years. But the real issue isn't about agriculture. It's about what do you do differently in agriculture and what are the job creation potential and possibilities within agriculture and how can we grow, for example, the agro-processing area. And that's the work that Minister Jimon Peterson's department will be doing. With a view to increasing job creation in that environment. And those of you that have constituents in this area might want to meet with them, give us some ideas about how things could be done differently and how job creation prospects could be expanded as well. You also ask about support to the private sector. There's the incentive scheme, for example, in GTI. That's one form of support, and we'd be willing to, like the youth subsidy, look at other forms of support as well. But there are various things within the budgetary framework and in different departments which support the private sector to create jobs. But the key is not what support the private sector receives, but whether the current upward trend in private sector investment, as you can see from the numbers, will be accelerated. And how do we create a climate in South Africa where there's greater private sector investment than we have currently in order to grow the economy? And this connects with the Honorable Turok's point as well about the real economy. Now, sin taxes. It's a pity I couldn't bring Minister Motsoaledi here. If I knew in advance, I would have brought him along. I was at a function this morning, and a young lady takes me aside and says, you know, the sin taxes, you need to put another levy on these people, right? Because of the social damage that these people are causing. Right? Now, so you have a debate in our society. It's about balances again. So the one part says I create jobs through the work that I do and the industry that I engage in all sorts of forms, and it's true. There's another part which says that the consumption of the product of this industry has all sorts of ill effects in our society. And in some parts of our country, and I've said this to some leaders in this industry very recently, that the health sector, for example, bears the consequences of what comes after the consumption process. And our social discord that we have, the violence that we have at a familial level, family level, some of the criminality that we have can be traced very directly to overconsumption of alcohol. So how we maintain those balances, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you can come up with the answer. So I don't think it's jobs versus sin taxes. I think the real issue is we need some change in social culture. Sin taxes all over the world are used precisely for that purpose, to discourage sin, however you want to define it. And one can also understand that this industry is going to do its bit to lobby. And we've been the subject of lobby, let alone any of you. To say, don't use this technique, use that technique to calculate the excise taxes. We've here heard them. Some of them might have a valid case. We certainly don't want to kill the industry because this is consumption that is part of your human right, if you like. But at the same time, overconsumption of anything, drugs, alcohol, is going to cause huge damage to society. Speed as well, yeah. But, I mean, you've got to balance it out at the end of the day. So we can put a sin tax on vehicles, if you like. Mr. George, I've answered your question about wage subsidy. You appear to tell us that as a parliamentary committee and as parliament, you have the prerogative in terms of the money bills, amendment procedure, and the Related Matters Act to actually make tax policy decisions. Now, that's how you came across. That's the prerogative of the executive. Now, let's be absolutely clear about that. What you can amend is the fiscal framework, which says, well, in our view, collectively, you need to have a deficit of 5.2 instead of 5.3, or 6 instead of 5.3. And we can debate the merits of that. So I don't think we must confuse passion about that on books or about books with about the necessity or where the decision-making processes lie in terms of tax policy and the absolute prerogative you have to both debate and decide on changes to the fiscal framework, which then gives us the opportunity to engage with you on those matters. As you know, the gentleman on my left has a big part to play with the Act itself. So the issue here is more than just about impact on the fiscal framework. It's about, you see, there's an argument which says that if you reduce VAT on books, ipso facto people will read more, right? There'll be more literacy in our society, that school books will operate on a different basis and will be more useful. And all we're trying to do is to say, let's be balanced about this. The state does make a huge contribution through the education budget on workbooks and other supplies. We want to also work with the Department of Education to look at the procurement processes in this area, for example, in the schools area. And we've done it very successfully in the recent past, as you know, with procuring antiretroviral. And huge savings have come about as a result of, let's call it centralized procurement for now. Now, we want to see how we can explore those lessons in other areas of procurement. I mean, procuring is one thing, as we've learned. Distributing them is another thing. And the provinces still have a huge difficulty in terms of getting school books to every pupil and learner in our school's environment. And that's a tragedy to have that kind of difficulty in the 21st century when logistics chains work efficiently for delivering newspapers or other commodities that are the subject of sin tax, which I won't mention. And they get to every corner of South Africa. Why can't we get school books to every corner of South Africa as well? So, you talk about the expansionary stance. I don't think this is precisely an expansionary stance. It's saying that the deficit, for reasons of revenue collection and extra money being spent on the floods, had to be adjusted slightly, 0.7%. But our net trend is still downwards. And ideally, we still have, I think the slide showed, what, 2.7% in terms of real growth in expenditure compared to 9, 10, 11, 12% in earlier years. So there's a downward trend in terms of real expenditure. There's a downward trend in terms of the deficit. And ultimately, there's going to be a downward trend in debt as well, including debt service costs also. So we want to make sure, and I don't know if I heard you correctly, but Chair, through you, Mr. George seemed to use the word impossible increases in taxes. Did I hear that right? No. Okay. So, oh, possible. Okay. I was wondering now, where is this coming from? Mr. Kornhoff, we also share your concern about debt service costs and the wage bill. And as Honorable Tirok was saying, this is about the balances as well. So, filling all vacancies, I think there's virtual consensus that the vacancies we're talking about are in service delivery areas. This is not in administration. I think some provinces have let us down very badly in this. And rather than appointing frontline service people, they've employed thousands of administrative staff. And that's really unacceptable in the current time. And so why it happens, how it happens, again, the NCOP and other structures of government should look into this. I don't think we look into it adequately. It's always left to the Treasury to come up and say this thing is happening. Why aren't we able to pick it up through normal parliamentary processes, as the Honorable Mufumadi was saying? It's still a mystery. And these are serious issues because there's billions of rands involved here. That is not necessarily being spent. And then we say our people don't get the right services. But we're putting people behind desks to do admin work rather than employing teachers, nurses, doctors, and other skilled staff that we require in the frontline services as well. So we agree with you that we need to look at this challenge. The Honorable Makubela, in terms of cooperation from the business community, all of us, Honorable Makubela, including the President, are actually trying to create a climate of dialogue with the business community. And as you know, the President has announced that he's having a major summit with them shortly and with labor so that we can try to build consensus around the growth path and other things that we need to do in our society. Matching skills and jobs, perhaps the DG or somebody else would like to address that. Just now they'll say I took all the work away from them. The Honorable Turok, we would share your point of departure, growing the real economy. But as you yourself have acknowledged, there's the issue of balance. So I think it'll be very useful to have a practical discussion about what are all the things that government needs to do, how much of money do we have to do it, and where do we want to assign that money to the best advantage of our society, recognizing that government is not the net producer of jobs in a society, and recognizing that the major investments also come from the private sector. And how we create conditions for that in various forms and how we incentivize that is part of the critical challenge. We spent and have spent, I've lost, the Annexure C has some of that information, but there's information elsewhere in the budget review, which indicated, if somebody can help me to say where it is, but the motor industry development plan, for example, has cost, on the average, if I can remember, somewhere between 15 and 17 billion rands for the 3 years that are covered. No, it's not here. It's another document I've seen. What is it here? Motor vehicle, MIDP. Yeah, oh, sorry, it is here. I saw it in a different form. So if you look at page 181 of the budget review, and go to the towards the bottom of the page, it says customs duties and excise. And the first column is motor vehicles. So if you look at the 4 years that are covered there, we talk about 28, 38, 41, 46, 56, 56 billion rands, plus minus, that has gone into the motor industry as our government subsidy to them. That's a lot of money. And that's the real economy. Next line, textile and clothing. This is through the duty credit scheme which government and the industry came up with. And total those numbers, they're also approximately just under 8 billion. 7 point something. And the other numbers are the ones that you find. So a total, if you look at the 4 years, 36, 56, 66, 72 billion rands in those sectors that are indicated there has gone in. This is outside of other incentive schemes that operate through the tax system for depreciated allowances and all sorts of things. We're working on the total count. So the real economy, we've got to also carefully do, because the real economy is not the factory. The real economy is also the road that services the factory. the trains that take goods from that factory to the points of export. So there's a huge investment, I think, if we see it that way, Chairperson, in the real economy. And it's perhaps what the real question is, how do we get the real economy really kicking? And it's not only about what government puts into it. As you know, with your expertise, there's a whole range of other factors that we need to focus on as well. And hopefully through some discussion, we can get that going. But we would share with you completely the emphasis that the real economy is a serious proposition and that we should do everything possible to support it, as long as you also agree that there are lots of other things we need to do to increase productivity, to increase competitiveness, to change the the logistics chains in South Africa, to reduce the cost of doing business in South Africa, because it's that combination, Chairperson, that we need to put together if we're going to succeed as an economy beyond where we are currently. No major projects in the Free State. Mr. Brown, please explain this. And I don't know whether hamburgers in the Free State are cheaper than elsewhere. But Mr. Brown can also address your question, maybe the Deputy Minister as well, on revenue collection. He has some ideas about what to do with the traffic police. Mr. Ramatlakane, Mr. Mavoniat, I think, is here on the banking regulation side, so he can address that. NHI funding options, he can also address that. Delegation of functions and money following, Mr. Brown. 9 billion rands, detail, Mr. Donaldson. FET colleges and 14 billion, Mr. Donaldson. The youth statistics, Mr. Louvout. And job creation, who's holding it together? It is indeed the cluster. Mr. Monsisi, FDI investment, DG, if you could just look at that number quickly. Sustainability of grants, Mr. Monsisi, we've addressed that earlier on. We absolutely agree with you. And if we can get this connection working between grants recipients, NGOs, social enterprises, actual EPW jobs, training, and real jobs, if you like, that's the continuum that we need to get working in South Africa. We will really be doing great things, and I think you're on the right track. Mr. Sogoni makes a very similar point, so we agree with you, Mr. Sogoni, as well on that issue. And the DFI report, Mr. Fuzile, is he here? That's his favorite topic, so he has to earn his salary for this morning. So can I then refer Chairperson through you to all of the gentlemen? Looks like the only gentleman here at the moment. This is a mad crowd, you see. Can please take on their respective questions.
Mr. Squire, you may proceed, Mr. Brown or whoever.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just on the MEG and the splitting of the MEG, because that is what I understood the question to be, so that it takes into account sporting facilities, particularly in rural areas. So, firstly, the splitting of MEG will not necessarily solve your problem, basically. What you have in rural areas is your urban core, where a lot of the municipalities, in any case, spend quite a bit of the MEG to address the sporting needs, basically, there. Currently, the discussion is a broader discussion between the Department of Sports and the Department of Education as to how do we use the schools, because of the dispersed nature of our rural communities, how do we use, for example, schools to be able to rather build the facilities within the schooling system there. So that's for sports. We can even extend it even further for things like libraries, for example, so that the school becomes actually a holistic center for community development in that kind of sense. So we are looking at a specific option there. On the question of EPWP, as I think this is the second year that the grant is actually running. But I think what is important here is the grant is an incentive grant. Basically, the municipality first, or the province for that matter, first needs to go and implement this program based on EPWP, and as it performs there, it then claims back basically part of that funding from national and that is in fact the performance now of the second phase of the EBWP is picking up quite rapidly. So what we expect in the future actually is that that grant would perform quite a bit better. On the Free State roads, honourable member there, we are adding 3.5 billion rand for all provinces to manage their road infrastructure. The grant over the next 3 years will be spending about 25 billion. It grows from 6.5 to close to about 8.3 billion there. The Free State gets about 600 million a year for that. And this point is not really only related to the Free State. I think what we need to do, and this is part of what the Minister of Transport will be starting to look at, is how do we enable provinces to manage their road infrastructure in a more kind of sustainable way through proper asset management of the entire roads infrastructure, basically. So there's quite a bit of that. You remember there's the issue around why is it such huge differential cost even in the management of roads across provinces, for that matter. If you go to your province, you're going to see they're spending close to 15 million rand a kilometer of road, while in another province they spend 7, 8 million rand a kilometer of road. So there is that kind of issue that we're also starting to look at basically there. The other project that I listed on the table are related to really big national kind of projects that relate to infrastructure for energy, water, etc. On the delegations issue, or on revenue collection, because you also asked a question around revenue collection, provinces, the largest source of revenue is really the motor vehicle license fees, basically. And what we generally see is there's quite a bit of strong growth as it relates to those motor vehicle licenses. And we need to actually link even that to the issue around road infrastructure. The provinces shouldn't only rely on national transfers to be able to fix their road infrastructure. They actually also need to link the what they collect in terms of road traffic access with that. The second kind of issue is how provinces actually prioritize as well. If the province prioritizes roads vis-a-vis the rest of the choices that it makes, basically, if it deems roads to be the priority, then we want to see that shift from non-core areas of spending towards roads. It will be surprising to see how provinces actually budget for some of the functions that they budget for, in any case. The only delegations, Honorable Ramatlakane, normally the principle that we follow there is funds follow function, in any case. What we start to see on the human settlement side is the funds will eventually be going basically to the relevant cities that are linked in terms of the human settlement function, basically. So what we had were the mixed cities, which will now directly move from the Minister of Human Settlements Department to the cities. On top of that, we've added further funding to address the issues around informal settlements. And what the Minister of Human Settlements, the department did, was to shave off quite a bit of the money of the housing subsidy and add it basically to that. So what you have is that specific kind of issue. So a similar principle would then follow as it relates to the rest of the other functions. Currently what we are discussing is the issue around the relationship between rail and the rest of the public transport infrastructure, basically there. So our thinking actually is for the rail subsidy to actually also go to the city, to allow the city actually to start to influence the entire public transport plan, because there it will start to, in its engagement with TRASA, start to dictate in a way where the capital program actually needs to go and which services needs to be rationalized, which services needs to be stepped up, etc. So there's that kind of relationship that we hope to see happening out of that interaction. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Mr. Donaldson?
Just a few comments. There was a question about the census budget, about 2.8 billion, 2.7 billion over the full 3 or 4 years that it takes to plan, prepare for, and implement, and then finally analyze the census. That is, I probably like a little bit more, but it is, they have put quite a bit of work in preparing for this census. in streamlining their capacity to deal with small towns, deal with rural areas, and so our understanding is that in important respect this will be a more cost-effective census, and they've had to deal with the logistical complexities of hiring several thousand temporary employees during the census, but also cooperating to some extent with municipalities who provide important voluntary or technical assistance for the implementation. So we'll see. It is a huge logistical operation, but we're, our understanding with Statistics SA is that we have enough money and we'll have a successful census this year. The question on FET colleges, 15 billion is the three-year number. FET colleges are still the responsibility of provinces, but the funding is now largely a flow of funds from the Department of Higher Education and in the form of a conditional grant. The thing to watch in this area, and remember these colleges were consolidated, they have a complete overhaul of curricula, they're under enormous pressure to step up their training, increase the flow of students, but the results so far have been very poor. We've seen high failure rates, and colleges are really under pressure to up the quality of their game. The thing to watch here is for better partnerships between the colleges and industry, and particularly the sector education training authorities, because that's where the big money is. The CETAs and the National Skills Fund have $9 billion or so at their disposal next year. Colleges' budgets is about $5 billion in total. And Minister Nzimande has quite rightly effectively challenged the colleges and challenged the CETAs to start working together better. And the CETAs are, in a sense, the test of quality, because CETAs will be able to make use of colleges if they're confident that those colleges are providing training that is useful in the workplace. And there's a dynamic there that is potentially the beginnings of better quality and better accountability in the sector. It's an enormously important investment in capacity and improving the quality of our vocational education, and certainly it needs to be kept under scrutiny. On the $9 billion jobs fund, I think it's important to say there still are aspects of the operationalization of that it should be sorted out. Work is in progress now on how this will operate, what the criteria will be. But in broad terms, what Cabinet has agreed to is a program of assistance for co-funding, partnering with organizations that are in the business of supporting job creation. And it will operate on what is sometimes called a challenge fund basis. What that means is that there will be invitations for proposals and then an assessment of those proposals, and agreements will be entered into with organizations or with businesses or with municipalities, and agreements that will have targets attached to them. And the funding will be sequenced. Successful projects will get increasing funding. Projects that go through difficulties will need to reconsider. And there is some international experience to draw on, also some business trust experience in our own context with projects of this kind. Just to give an example of the kinds of things that are likely to be funded, projects that assist young people in the job search challenge. Job search is difficult. Finding out about work opportunities and getting access to interviews, to developing the preliminary skills that are needed to get into that first job. And there are interesting proposals from several organizations, kinds of initiatives in that area. We clearly need to do more to build the kind of infrastructure in townships and rural communities that create trading, secure trading opportunities and trading space. And so the trading infrastructure that assists small producers and small businesses, particularly in communities in rural areas, kinds of projects that like to be assisted. Access of small producers to markets.
needs assistance. That's partly about getting into the transport and logistics chain. It's partly also about meeting quality standards and projects that provide assistance to small producers, emerging farmers, to meet the quality standards, meet the phytosanitary standards and so on, that improve access into the established markets, not just in our own market, but also over time into the regional economy and potentially into exports. So those are the kinds of programs that we will look for here. The big social responsibility funds that are supported by the corporate sector are likely to be partners of the Jobs Fund here, but I think it's important to say also that there are a range of government agencies, development agencies, municipalities who themselves will be candidates for additional funding through that program. And then just lastly on the bringing the employer contribution is retirement funds into the fringe benefits arrangement. No question this is a long overdue reform. It makes so much more sense. You talk to people from the industry, they immediately say that'll make things so much simpler. It makes so much more to ensure that when an employer makes retirement fund contributions, that those are attributed to the employees who benefit from them and that they're treated as part of the DAC structure. So there's an important simplification here that just makes a lot of sense, and it certainly is consistent with the reforms that are under consideration in the social security process.
Anyone else that wants to come in?
I would have to refer to the youth unemployment rate. The working age population starts at 15, so the slide that you've got is the most accurate breakdown of the different age groups. The number used in the speech was 18 to 29-year-olds, and that's a 42% unemployment rate. If you look at the graph, you can see that the bulk of the unemployed would actually in nominal numbers would be between the 20 to 24 and 25 to 29, and you get about an average of 42, so that's sort of 42% unemployment rate. There are not many unemployed between 15 and 17. I don't know the exact number. Could I also respond? There was a question about the growth rate, which I thought one might respond to just very briefly. So we moved it from 3.5 to 3.4 between the MTVPS and the budget, and the primary reason for that was the quite poor third quarter outcome for 2010. As it turns out, the fourth quarter came out better than we expected, or better than we were able to build into our forecast for the budget. So we had, I think, 3.8 in the budget for the fourth quarter, and the outcome was 4.4. So that would actually push up the growth rate for 2011 a little bit.
Anyone else? Back.
Thank you, Chair. I think there were just a few questions asked. I think, firstly, just with regard to bank regulations, I think what was announced yesterday that on the regulatory system we're moving towards what we call the twin peak model, so that we can do much better the two basic things you want to do when you regulate the financial sector. Firstly, there's the prudential, which focuses on the soundness of these institutions, and secondly, on market conduct. And I think that to some extent, some of the things that they're supposed to do is already being implemented. So if you take the banking sector, discussions on getting higher capital reserves and so on through the Basel III process, those things were already are beginning to happen. Banks are preparing for that. With the insurance industry, there's, for example, the SAM initiative. So there's a lot of movement there already, even as we structure, as we move towards this twin peak system. With regard to some of the market conduct issues, similarly, the FSB has the Treat Customers Fairly initiative, which I think is an important initiative, and so there's movement in that respect. Having said that, I think these are not easy issues to also resolve. Just because you have a market conduct regulator doesn't mean you're going to get low fees. And I think that that's a challenge that we face, and really the powers that we have on the one hand are moral suasion, on the other hand, obviously, just to make sure their market conduct practices, the fact that they provide information to customers make you aware of the fees, etc., are made much more transparent and user-friendly. With regard to the last, there was, I think, Honorable Sigoni asked a question on co-ops. There's a lot of legislation which falls under DTI and some initiatives there to get co-ops going. But there's also the whole area of co-op banking and so on is an area that there's an agency within which reports to the Minister of Finance, which is supposed to take it a step further. There's some reference to it in this document which deals with the Twin Peaks. You would have that in a, if you look at under the section on inclusiveness or access in the financial sector. With regard to NHI, I think I'm not going to say much more than what the Minister has really said in his speech, but that obviously the proposal will be published sometime in the new year. But in terms of the funding options, the Minister did highlight that firstly, there is a 10-point plan. Some of it has already been implemented in the national health system. But to the extent that further funding may be required, that we would have to look at options like either increasing VAT or increasing the payroll or putting a surcharge on income tax. I think the Minister emphasized that all of these would have to be explored. We need to look at their impacts. And depending on how over the next 14 years, this process is implemented, that will determine to what extent we would have to, whether there's a need for more taxes and which taxes. I think, Chair, yeah, that's about it.
Any other responses outstanding?
Yes, a quick
one. There is a gentleman.
Quick one, Honorable Chair. On the possibility of the DFI review report being shared with Parliament, that can be arranged. Just to add another small point on the issue of the projects on page 56 being located in some provinces and not in others, the electricity ones are only located in the provinces where there is coal, but they will generate energy for the rest of the country, for an example.
So that energy in Upington, you can come to Upington, I'll take you there. Anyone else? Honourable Minister, last word from you.
Chairperson and honourable members, thank you very much for once again this opportunity to engage with you and your very probing and constructive questions. We hope we've satisfied either your curiosity or your need to know some of these things better. But clearly, as you've been saying, Chairperson, that we need to move beyond this stage into actually checking whether things are being done. And there's enough money around, there's lots of ideas around, and we need to move on some of these matters as a matter of urgency. And of course, we will come back to you with issues like the fiscal guidelines and so on, and get some guidance from you as well on how we manage the processes around some of those issues. So thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you to the Honourable Minister and to the members for their questions. Honourable Thabo Mofumahadi will do the closing remarks. It's very clear from this budget presentation that there is tight fiscal discipline, that we want to give dignity to our people and to give South Africa a credible standing in the world. Honourable Mofumahadi.
No, there's nothing to say, Co-Chairperson, but also just to thank the Minister and his team, and probably agree with the Minister that we have said all what we wanted to say in the past in terms of policy and legislative arrangements. What remains is the implementation of what we have been saying all this time. I just sent a note to the DG asking him, when did we have the first job summit and what was the outcome of that job summit? And he says 1998. That was under the leadership of President Mandela. Job creation fund was set aside in that summit. In this budget, we have got 9 billion set aside for job creation. The question is, what are we going to do differently? And I think that's the biggest challenge we have. But we'll reserve our final conclusions on this matter, Honorable Minister and your team, because we're going to be embarking on a public hearing, the first and the second, next week. And the committee will have a deliberation on Friday to adopt its own report, and the debate is going to be on the 8th in the NA and the 9th in the NCOP. And I think that debate should actually begin to tease these issues. Perhaps Parliament has not been what it has characterized itself to be, the fourth democratic parliament, activist parliament. It is not what it has characterized itself to be. Otherwise, some of these issues would be not be asking questions today as to where are we in terms of this program. So I thought I should just make comment. The second comment is around the financial sector transformation. We will also tease this issue as we deal with the public participation and the committee itself, to go beyond the regulatory aspect of the proposals and strengthening of the regulatory environment of the financial services institutions, particularly the FSB itself. I think there are issues that need to be looked into in that regard. The rest, I think, will remain in the domain of honorable members to deal with. There is this report of the DFIs, which has been very difficult to extract. You know, we don't know what are the reasons. Maybe I'll talk to the deputy minister in private to find out what is the issue around that particular matter. Members have been asking for this report and all that, so that can help us to unpack. Yes. No. We have agreed, Deputy Minister, that you'll interact with us. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Minister, and your team. And let me thank our colleagues from provinces for spending time here in Cape Town with us. And we hope this interaction will help us to process this budget and the division of revenue matters within a very, very short space of time, because time is not on our side, but we'll have to do justice to every aspect of the budget. Thank you very much. So don't disappear, because there's still a second presentation. Minister, you are really...
2 o'clock.
We are here.
Yeah, 2 o'clock. The appropriations committees will continue with the meeting. It's now time to have some refreshments. Same menu.
Good luck with that.